If you looked, you would see that chapter 47 is not very long. It's not something that I think would consume our entire time. So we're going to cover 47 and probably a portion of 48. If you recall, as we continued here, we were looking at chapters 46 on and saying that the Lord is using these chapters to now discuss judgment that was going to be coming to the Gentile nations. So the interesting thing about it is that we tend to look at things linear and we figure, okay, well, Judah fell to the Babylonians, and then we read last week about Egypt, and this week it's going to be Philistia, which is with the Philistines, obviously, and but these things aren't happening in sequence. When Jeremiah is preaching, Jeremiah, you have to remember he's giving the warning, but that doesn't mean that the event has happened. So, in the case of Egypt that we talked about last week, and in the case of Philistia that we're talking about today, these are warnings that Jeremiah went into those nations to proclaim to them, but it was before the complete fall and destruction of Judah. So most of the time it looks like these things are happening roughly about 10 years before the fall of Judah. So appears to still be at the time of Jehoiakim. Now, there's always confusion when we talk about the Philistines. You can think of like modern day Israel, and there's this constant battle between Israel and the Palestinians. And a lot of people equate the Palestinians to the Philistines, and scripturally that's not true. So what happens is, I believe it was Yasser Arafat was the first one to try to make that connection, but the whole purpose of it was to be able to show that the Palestinians occupied the land before Israel came into it. So they're trying to show that they have a right to that land, and that's why they want Israel out. But the fact is that there was no correlation between the Philistines and the Palestinians. And the Philistines themselves were not inherent to that area of the country. The Philistines actually came out of a small island off of Crete. So they migrated across the Aegean Sea and settled in the southern coast of the Mediterranean. And from there began to populate that area and grow their forces. Now the thing that we have to look at is that when the Assyrians came in and attacked the northern kingdom of Israel, that area along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, I had a map there. Alicia, I think you have I have a map up here on the piano if you want to grab one. There's one on the front and the back, but the one on the front, it says Moab and Ammon, but I'm not so concerned about that right now as I am. So if you see on the west side of this where the Mediterranean Sea is, you see like Gaza, Ashkelon, Joppa, Dor, Akko, Tyre, and Sidon going up the coast there. So the Philistines occupied this section of land, and when the Assyrians came in to attack Israel, the northern kingdom, they invaded the Philistines as well. And the Philistines were greatly, their strength was greatly reduced after that happened. So when Nebuchadnezzar came in and attacked Judah, it was, well, Nebuchadnezzar obviously overthrew Assyria. And then when he came in and attacked Judah, he also attacked the Philistines and easily overthrew them because they weren't able to mount much of a defense. So when we start in verses 1 and 2, well, okay, before I go there, the one reason why there's confusion about the whole Palestine-Philistines thing, one of the problems is that in the Assyrian language, they called the Philistines the Palastu. And because of that, people call them Palestinians. So they're not related at all to the Palestinians. So as we will see today when we go through this. But what you'll see in verses 1 and 2 of Jeremiah 47, it says, "The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet against the Philistines before that Pharaoh smote Gaza." Now, if you know, a lot of these things kind of go together, but if you remember last time we were together, we were talking about Egypt, and Egypt initially came up into Israel, and Josiah, the king, went against Egypt and was killed at Megiddo. They wanted to stop the Egyptians from moving north because the Egyptians wanted to come north in order to attack Babylon. But Josiah wanted to stop them before they crossed his country, and he ended up dying. So what this is saying is that now this is talking about a time before Pharaoh comes up and invades the Philistines. And it says, so it's before the time that Pharaoh smotes Gaza. And of course, on the map, you see Gaza is right on the southern west part of the map. So it would be one of the first cities that Egypt would come into when they come up north. Now, if you understand, like, this is not a relief map, but if you understand the topography, where the water is, where the Mediterranean Sea is, that's going to be the lower ground, right? So when Egypt comes up, they're going to come up easily through that area because it's not the mountainous region. So there was I think on the other map you'll see that there's another section that travels between the two mountain ranges, and it's called the King's Highway, and that's on the right side of the Dead Sea. So when the armies from the south are moving north, they're going to travel in the valley areas because those are the easy ones to travel. So what we have here is a prophecy, obviously, that Jeremiah is telling the Philistines that even before Egypt comes up to attack you, this is what's going to happen. And in verse 2 he says, "Thus saith the Lord, behold, waters rise up out of the north and shall be an overflowing flood, and shall overflow the land and all that is therein, the city and them that dwell therein. Then the men shall cry, and all the inhabitants of the land shall howl." So, again, I mean, it's another one of those symbolisms that talks about the armies of the Babylonians being equated to a flood. They're going to come in like rushing waters. So they're going to come in very quickly, and they're going to come in with a lot of power. Just like, you know, it's hard to stop water as it's flooding anything. It's very powerful. So what happens here is, if you think back, the Lord is judging them, and you're like, well, okay. It was easy to understand why he judged Egypt, because, you know, they put the nation of Israel into slavery for 400 years. And then, you know, tried to attack them even after they came out of Egypt. And the Lord had to part the Red Sea and all that stuff. And there was always battles between Judah and Egypt. So, you know, it's natural to understand why the Lord would have a problem with Egypt. And, of course, we know Egypt is always a symbolism of sin in the scripture. But, you know, the Philistines, they're just as bad, because the Philistines are constantly attacking Israel, even before it was split into a northern kingdom, southern kingdom. So there's always war going on between the Philistines and Israel. And one of the primary battles that you're going to remember, I'm sure, was when Eli's sons decided to take the Ark of the Covenant into battle with the Philistines, and they lost, and the Ark went into the hands of the Philistines. Well, things didn't go so well with the Philistines once the Ark was in their territory. So in the first book of Samuel, chapter 6, we have this little account, and I say that because, you know, we believe it's factual, it's historical. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, verses 17 and 18, it talks here about five cities in the Philistines, and those cities are the ones that you see listed on the map, Gaza, Ashkelon, and I guess I don't have them all, Ashdod, Geth, and Ekron. So when you read this, it says, these are the golden emeralds which the Philistines returned for a trespass offering unto the Lord. For Ashdod 1, for Gaza 1, for Ashkelon 1, for Gath 1, for Ekron 1. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but if you remember, the Lord brought upon the Philistines really bad hemorrhoids, and they decided that they were going to fashion what they call mice, but they were golden images of their hemorrhoids that they put back in the ark, and one for each city, because they had five major cities and five kings that were in charge of those cities. And they decided that it was best to get rid of the ark and send it back to Israel, and use the golden emeralds as their offering unto the God of Israel. And then in verse 18, you can see it says, and the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both of fenced cities and of country villages, even unto the great stone of Abel, whereon they set down the ark of the Lord, which stone remaineth unto this day in the field of Joshua the Bethshemite. So they put the ark on a cart, and they just set the oxen free to point them towards Israel, and the oxen stop at this place of Joshua the Bethshemite. And of course, you know, as best we understand, the Philistines' issues, their physical issues, resolved themselves, and the ark remained in Israel. Now, um, Let's see. Oh, so, yeah, here we go. Since Jeremiah is speaking of this time when Egypt is, prior to Egypt invading Gaza, it almost seems like there's a problem because we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar coming in and being the one to be the judge of the Philistines. So then you might think that Jeremiah got it wrong. But it's just timing. The Egyptians come up and invade Gaza, but all that does is it weakens the Philistines, just like when the Assyrians came down from the north. And when Nebuchadnezzar comes in, he finds that they can't put up much of a fight. So their cities fall fairly quickly, even though, I can't say that. Their cities, they're unable to really mount much of an attack, but the cities are strongholds, so they're able to hold out, much like Jerusalem, where the people had retreated into the city, expecting that they would be safe. And, Nebuchadnezzar's armies were very patient and laid siege on it. Like for Jerusalem, if I remember correctly, I think it was 18 months. But for the Philistines, substantially longer than that. So what we'll see is that we know that the Lord tells Jeremiah that he's chosen him to be the one, to be the prophet, to go out to speak to the nation of Israel, Judah, and all the nations. So when he says all the nations, these are inclusive of these nations that God is now talking about. So up to this time, we don't see a lot of Jeremiah speaking to the Gentile nations. But this is what this section of Scripture is for as we continue on from chapters 46 through 51, I believe. It'll be all dealing with the Gentile nations. Now, in verses, back in Jeremiah 47, verses 3 to 5, it says, at the noise of the stamping of the hoofs of his strong horses, at the rushing of his chariots, and at the rumbling of his wheels, the fathers shall not look back to their children for feebleness of hands. Because of the day that cometh to spoil all the Philistines and to cut off from Tyrus and Sidon every helper that remaineth. For the Lord will spoil the Philistines, the remnant of the country of Kaphtor. Baldness is come upon Gaza. Ashkelon is cut off with the remnant of their valley. How long wilt thou cut thyself? So this is, what we're going to see in this chapter, this very short chapter, is the Lord begins to name a number of the cities that are going to be involved. And when we pointed it out on the map, you'll see that it goes all the way from the south all the way to the north. So, Gaza up through Tyre and Sidon, the Sidon at the top is the Zidon that we read in this scripture. So all the way from the south all the way to the north of this map that you're looking at, he's talking about the invasion that's going to come, and that's going to come with such fierceness that the fathers are going to turn and run, and they're not even going to think about leaving their sons behind. So, normally, you would expect the father, especially like a military man, his whole purpose would be to protect not only his nation but his family. And in this particular situation, there was such fear that came upon them that they just ran and didn't even consider that they left their families behind. It's really a sad statement on, you know, the state of things there. But all right, so he talks about, you know, the helpers will be spoiled and cut off, and you know, this is the Philistines having alliance with the cities of Sidon and Tyre, so that they would come to their aid when trouble came. But of course, the trouble is coming from the north, so they can't come and help them. So, you know, that's why this is problematic, because their alliance doesn't work when those that they're aligned with, are already being invaded, right? So it's problematic. He then speaks of the baldness of coming upon Gaza, and obviously we understand baldness, right? I mean, you say that your head is clean shaven, so there's nothing on it, right? So it's a symbolism of that which is being stripped clean. So everything that they have is either removed or destroyed. And then he talks about them cutting themselves. And, you know, this is one of those things, I don't know if you've ever seen any of the events that many of these folks in that part of the world deal with, but they think that it's important to their God that they inflict pain upon themselves at times. So you'll see them whipping themselves and they'll cut themselves. So they think that if they draw blood, that it's pleasing to their God. And the issue obviously is that their gods aren't able to help them in this situation. So, you know, the sword's going to come upon them and every one of these cities is going to fall. And then in verses 6 and 7, it just kind of confirms that. So it says, O thou sword of the Lord, how long will it be ere thou be quiet? Put up thyself into thy scabbard, rest and be still. How can it be quiet, seeing the Lord hath given it a charge against Ashkelon and against the seashore? There hath he appointed it. So this, I mean, this is pretty straightforward, because, you know, the question becomes one like, how long are you going to allow this to go on, you know? So the sword is going to come in and they're going to basically destroy them, just like they did. Well, we talk about Judah, but Judah hasn't fully happened yet. But just like we read about Judah, where the sword, the pestilence, the famine, those three things come upon them, and the people are going to have the sword of the armies of the Babylonians come in, and he says, how long is this going to go? When are you going to put the sword back in its sheath, so back in the scabbard? And what we have to understand, when I spoke earlier and I said that these were defensed cities, they were reinforced cities. So like Sidon and Tyre, when Nebuchadnezzar came and attacked them, they didn't fall quickly. It actually took like 13 years for him to overcome them. So this is why Jeremiah is like questioning, like, how long is this going to go on? Because it's a long time, right? We recently, obviously, have looked at like the war in Afghanistan, where we spent 20 years there. And it's, and, you know, we don't want to talk about the outcome, but it, you know, like, people were saying, like, enough is enough. Why are we still there, right? You know, when you go in and you occupy and you destroy the enemy, you're pretty happy with your army. But as it continues to drag on, then you start to lose the willingness of the people, right? So Jeremiah is told to prophesy to them that this is going to happen. And, you know, I don't know if Jeremiah gets to see a vision of everything that's going to happen, but he knows that it's going to be a long time. So he begins to wonder, like, you know, how long How long is God's judgment going to last upon these people? Now, you know, you can pretty much, you know, we continue to say that God's judgment is just, and it's always in correlation to the atrocity of the people. So when you think 13 years, that's a pretty long time. But when you think of it compared to Israel and them going into captivity for 70 years, it's not so long. So you can see how God holds, these were Gentile nations. They have their own deities and everything. So they're not worshiping Jehovah God. So even though, you know, they're worshiping other gods, their real problem is the fact that God holds them accountable for their treatment of Israel. And, you know, 13 years is somehow God's viewpoint of how long this needed to go on before he would allow the judgment to pass. But the problem is that the Philistines, their land was invaded, and just like Israel and Judah, people were killed, people were taken captive, and they were taken out of the land and removed into different parts of the Babylonian Empire. Well, at that point, which I believe was like 605 BC, the Philistines ceased to exist. Much like, you know, Israel ceased to exist for a while after the Romans came in, right? But they came back because that was God's design, that they would always be his people, and he wasn't done with them yet. He still had more plans for them. But the Philistines, nope, they're gone. So, you know, people wondered, like, how come we don't have any record of these people? The majority of the record that you have historically is coming right out of Scripture. But there was record that was found of the Philistines when Ramses, the Pharaoh of Egypt, came into the Philistia and attacked them. So they have now seen that there was a people called the Philistines in that area of the country. But they don't exist anymore. They've been assimilated into other cultures, and now they're gone. So they won't be coming back. And, you know, that's probably a lot worse when you think of a judgment of a nation, that they're no longer a people, you know. But, you know, that's all God's doing. So, you know, we don't judge God. That's up to him. But at some point, you know, the sword will be removed and it will be sheathed, but not until God's will is accomplished. So you can question it, like, when's it going to happen? But it happens. It's going to come in God's time, and it's going to go away in God's time. And God's will is going to be fulfilled in it. All right. Now, that ends 47. Now, 48 kind of picks up similar to that, because chapter 48 also begins to name a lot of cities. And I tried on the map that we're going to look at to circle with, you know, light red circles all the cities that God's going to mention here within this chapter. And you can pretty well see that there's a pretty thorough invasion of Moab here in chapter 48. And just because some of these other cities aren't specifically mentioned doesn't mean that they got off. But they were not the major cities that the Lord wanted us to be aware of. So there's quite a few of them. So if you look at chapter 48, you're going to see that it says, "Against Moab, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, woe unto Nebo, for it is spoiled. Kiriathaim is confounded and taken. Mizgab is confounded and dismayed." Now, I couldn't find all of these cities on a map, so I found the ones that I could find, and I circled those. But Obviously, again, we have God's judgment coming against Moab. Well, what does God have against Moab? I mean, we said that it always seems to be something about their effect on God's chosen people, right? Well, if you think back, Moab as a people, the Moabites, came from Lot, and Lot having an incestuous relationship with his daughters. So when the Lord brought the fire upon Sodom and Gomorrah, and they saved Lot out of the city, and I guess his daughter-in-laws, then we know at some point they went into a cave, and then his daughter-in-laws decided to get intimate with him, and they got pregnant, and then the Moabite nation was born from that incestuous relationship. Now, obviously that's sinful. That should never have happened. But it gets worse, because when you think about it, that means that they were brethren of the Jews, because they come from Lot, and but they hated the Jews. So at every occasion, they caused problems with the Jews. I'm just not sure if I was, I think that's right. Yeah, so on every occasion they caused problems with the Jews. And when the Jews came out of Egyptian captivity, they came up through the land of Moab, and the Moabites wouldn't let them rest in the land. They wouldn't let them take food and water. They wanted them to pass right through and get out of the land. So there are a lot of problems that are happening with the Moabites. And if you go back to Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, it says, this was God already letting Jeremiah know the nations that were going to, he was going to have to come up against and prophesy to about God's judgment. Verse 25, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will punish all them which are circumcised with the uncircumcised. Egypt and Judah and Edom and the children of Ammon and Moab and all that are in the utmost corners that dwell in the wilderness. For all these nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel are uncircumcised in the heart." So, I mean, God has a problem with them all. I mean, they're all the Gentile nations for sure, but even Israel, God considers them to be uncircumcised in the heart because they're not following the Lord. Now, in 2 Kings chapter 24, the first two verses, we got a discussion about the Syrians and the Babylonians when they come in and attack Israel and Judah. And when we read this section of scripture, we find out that the Moabites were actually happy that the Israelites were being attacked. So 2 Kings 24, verses 1 and 2, it says, "In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him." Jehoiakim was the king of Judah. "And the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldeans and bands of the Syrians and bands of the Moabites and bands of the children of Ammon and sent them against Judah to destroy it. according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servants, the prophets. And then if you turn over to 1 Kings, chapter 11, this gives us a little understanding of King Solomon. Remember when Solomon took over the kingdom? The kingdom was united. There was no war. Solomon was to build the temple to the Lord. And Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived, right? And then what happened was he started to take wives, many wives of other nations. And they turned his heart against the Lord, and concubines and the whole bit. So when we're in 1 Kings chapter 11, we're at a point where Solomon is already on the decline here. And in verses 30 to 33, Ahijah, who was the priest at the time, caught the new garment that was on him and rent it in 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take thee 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and I will give 10 tribes to thee. So, of course, we understand that those are the northern tribes, right? That God is letting him know that the nation of Israel is going to be split. So there's going to be the northern tribes and the southern tribes. Verse 32, but he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Zidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways to do that which is right in mine eyes, and to keep my statutes and my judgments as did David his father. So what happens is we see that the Moabites, these women that come in and turn Solomon's head away from Jehovah, bring with them their god Chemosh. And because of that, God has to now judge the nation of Israel and splits it, and Solomon ends up having his own issues there. So the Moabites end up, they become the people that have caused Israel a lot of problems. And that becomes their reason for judgment now from the Lord. And then, I think we started verse 1. Okay, so in verses 1 to 5 here, it says, against Moab, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, woe unto Nebo, for it is spoiled. Kiriathaim is confounded and taken. Mizgab is confounded and dismayed. There shall be no more praise of Moab. In Heshbon they have devised evil against it. Come and let us cut it off from being a nation. Also thou shalt be cut down, O madman. The sword shall pursue thee. A voice of crying shall be from Hironaim, spoiling and great destruction. Moab is destroyed. Her little ones have caused a cry to be heard. For in the going up of Luhith, continual weeping shall go up. For in the going down of Hironaim, the enemies have heard a cry of destruction. So, again, these are cities that are all listed. Just in these five verses, there's a number of them. But you can see, like, almost just a little below the center of the map, you've got Mad Men and Hironaim. And then you go up towards the top, and you'll have your Heshbon up at the north, the very top circle. And again, I mean, it's just a picture of the destruction that's going to be coming throughout the entire land of Moab. And then verse 6 of chapter 48 says, flee, save your lives, and be like the heath in the wilderness. Now, this is really I guess they can flee, but they're not going to get away. I mean, it's kind of like I don't know, satirical, ironic, I don't know, metaphorical. Yeah. You can run, but you can't hide, kind of thing, right? So he says, you can run, but you're going to be like the heath in the wilderness. Now, I didn't know what that was, so I had to look it up. But the heath is a kind of a juniper plant, and it's described as a small plant with leaves close to the stem. It's gloomy looking, and it grows on a sterile soil. And the person who described this says that it's like a man that trusteth in man and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord. So in Hebrew, that word heath means naked. So it's the same kind of thing as being bald, right? So it's being stripped of everything. So when they talk about it, they're talking about a shrub that grows in a desolate area, and it has no value. It's not pretty to look at. So, you know, you can flee, but ultimately, you're not gonna look very pretty by the time they're done with you. All right, and then in verses 7 and 8, we can see that. You know, when he talked about them being people that trusted in man and maketh his flesh his arm, we see that in verses 7 and 8. It says, for because thou hast trusted in thy works and in thy treasures, thou shalt also be taken, and Chemosh shall go forth into captivity with his priests and his princes together, and the spoilers shall come upon every city, and no city shall escape. The valley also shall perish, and the plain shall be destroyed, as the Lord hath spoken. Now, Chemosh is apparently a place where they had a temple to their god, who I think we just called Chemoth. And they're talking about the fact that that's going to be destroyed, and their priests, their princes, all together with them. So, you know, they have the same problem that Jerusalem has, where they trusted in the fact that, you know, their military was strong, they had a fortified city, they had plenty of food and water, and they could last a long time. Well, apparently not long enough. So it's another one of those situations where if you put your trust in man and the man is fighting against God, God wins every time. And that's exactly what they're talking about here. So they had priests and princes who told the people, just like in Judah, oh, everything is fine. Don't listen to this guy, Jeremiah. It's not a problem. We don't have to worry about it. And then, of course, what happens is Babylon comes in and overthrows them. So, you know, it's another one of those things where, you know, who are you going to believe? Do you believe Jehovah God when he says something's going to happen? Or do you believe man when they say, oh, no, that's that God of Israel. There's no way that's going to happen. And then you trust in your own gods. And when they talk about thy treasures, as we said, this place, Chemosh, where they have their temple, they had their gods made out of silver and gold, just like Judah had theirs. And when the Babylonians come in, they obviously take those, and they're going to bring them back to Babylon as spoils of the war, right? But of course, you know, when you come in and you take somebody's gods, it becomes very evident that your gods weren't able to do anything for you. So that's kind of the whole idea. You know, where are you going to put your trust, right? You can put your trust in man. You can put your trust in the stock market. You can put your trust in the money that you have in the bank. You can put your trust in other gods, you know, whoever it might be. But ultimately, Jehovah God is the God, is the God, Lord of Lords and King of Kings, right? All right. Verse 9, it says, give wings unto Moab, that it may flee and get away, for the cities thereof shall be desolate without any to dwell therein. And again, this is sarcastic, because he's saying that if you give Moab wings, she'll be able to fly away, and she'll be able to escape. Well, of course, she's not going to get wings. So, you know, if the people could fly away, that would be great. But, you know, ultimately, it's not going to happen. So if you look at Psalm 55, I believe this was a Psalm of David. And he says, he's at a low point here, right? So he says in verses 4 to 6, my heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me, and horror hath overwhelmed me. And I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then would I fly away and be at rest. And that's kind of the gist, right? When you see that you have an overwhelming force coming against you, your prayer is, oh, I wish I could just fly away and not have any of these issues. But, of course, that's not going to happen. So, you know, but, I mean, that even David had that thought. But that thought didn't help him. God helped him. So then in verse 10, back in Jeremiah 48, it says, cursed be he that doeth the work of the Lord deceitfully, and cursed be he that keepeth back his sword from blood. Now, this is kind of an odd verse, but the gist is that what the Lord is saying is that he's going to curse any of the Babylonian army that comes in that refuses to fulfill what God's judgment is against Moab. So he says, if you don't do the work of the Lord, I mean, obviously, the Babylonians have no idea that they're working on behalf of Jehovah God, but they believe that they're coming in because that's what Nebuchadnezzar wants them to do. But God says, don't you dare hold back your sword from these people. If you do, I am going to curse you. So you will end up suffering the same penalty that they are supposed to suffer. So God has we would say God is angry, right? And I don't say that to say that we have an angry, vindictive God, but I say that to say that God was very long-suffering, and at some point his long-suffering ended. And he says, now is the time. You've had many, many years, many, many kings, many, many prophets of Israel and Judah that have told you about our God. You have seen the acts of God as God has protected his people from the Philistines when they came in. And, you know, you've seen what he has done to the northern kingdom, because at that point, the northern kingdom had already been conquered by Assyria. And, you're talking about a God who's capable of doing whatever he says is to be done. And the people that are around Israel and Judah are supposed to be able to look at this and learn from it. And I guess if you've come from a family where you have multiple kids in your family, like when I grew up, I was one of four. And when my older brother got into trouble, I would see the trouble that he got into and the result of that trouble when my father would punish him. And for me, I wasn't stupid. I said, well, I'm not going to do that because I don't want that kind of punishment, right? So it's the same kind of deal. You know, God didn't do this in a bubble where nobody knew what was going on. Because remember, as Israel was being punished, he said, I'm going to make you a curse and a byword. Well, curse and a byword to who? To the nations around you who are going to come through and say, wasn't this once a great nation? But now look at it. It's desolate. There's nothing growing here. The animals, the beasts of the field are taking over. And that's the gist. They should have seen the power and the strength of Israel's God and said, oh, we don't want to be on the wrong side of that God, right? And, you know, that's a terrible way to have to come to understand God. But, you know, it's still no different in our day and age. We people love to think of God as, you know, the grandfather type who just loves everybody. And as long as you did something wrong and said, oh, I'm sorry, that, you know, everything's fine. Well, it can be if you've already put your faith and trust in his son, Jesus Christ. But if you haven't believed in his son as the only begotten son of God who came and died for our sins and paid the price we couldn't pay, then, you know, you can apologize to God all you want, but you're still on the wrong side of God's standard. And that's exactly what we're looking at here with these Gentile nations. And God says, I've called Babylon to come in, and they're going to now be judge and executioner. God's the judge. They're going to be the executioner of God's will. And he says, you know, don't you dare hold back from doing my will in this situation. Now, you know, that's got to be something that, you know, after the fact, when Jeremiah's writing, remember he's having the book written, and when the book goes to the captives, where they now learn about, oh, you're going to be there 70 years, but don't worry, God has made it possible for you to come back into your land, where, you know, that sounds really great. Well, what about the part where Babylon reads this and God says, well, I've been the one who's orchestrated this whole thing and you guys are just my puppets. Do you think they would be real happy about hearing that? I would say no, but, you know, the bottom line is we understand what happens after the fact, right? The Medo-Persian Empire rises up and destroys Babylon, we understand that Cyrus is the one who sees the truth of what's in the book and says, oh, I believe what your God said is true. And not just for the reason that he's destroyed all these places, but God already said, hey, you're going to come back, you're going to build the temple, and now, hey, look, this is exactly what's happening, right? So, you know, a lot of things that God does are not only for the people being impacted at the time, but for other people who live in that day and age, and for us who live in the day and age that we're in. So, you know, it's a really amazing book when you think about it that way. We have to somehow expand our thoughts sometimes so that we're not just pigeonholed into the day and the age that we're dealing with. But it's important to understand the day and the age so that you understand who the book was written to. But think about the impact that it has over the years as other people are reading it. And that's exactly why, you know, people that have, like I'll say a lot of the Jewish people who had only the Old Testament, portions of the Old Testament, end up becoming Messianic Jews because when they read the New Testament, they can see that so much that was spoken of in the Old Testament points to Jesus Christ and what the New Testament speaks about. So God has an amazing way of writing things where it becomes evident to people of different generations and different nationalities, different belief systems, and it's impactful. It's authoritative, and that's really the amazing thing. So, that's kind of where we're at today. We're going to stop here, and then we'll continue on next time. So we will be together next week. It's the week after that we won't have a study. So, all right. And we'll announce that again, you know, the next couple of services. All right. So.